Welcome to Libre Lounge, a podcast about free software, free culture, and all the other interesting aspects of user freedom, with Christopher Lemmer-Weber and Serge Roklowski.
Hi, I'm Serge. I use he, him pronouns.
Hi, I'm Chris. I use non-binary pronouns such as they, them.
So, welcome to Libre Lounge. People have been asking us for off-the-cuff episodes with no planning and no editing, right? That's what people want. So that's what you're going to get, I guess. Because as we're recording this, we're stuck in the COVID-19 pandemic. I think we're both stuck at home.
And Libre Lounge off the hook.
Yeah. Well, off the hook's another show.
Oh, okay.
So it's just Libre Lounge. And so we're gonna do more episodes, but they're gonna be with way less planning. Although we have a guest scheduled for that we're gonna record later this week. We've got a couple of episodes. I'm the editor, so I ended up editing, but sometimes it takes me a long time to complete a show. So things that we record don't necessarily come out in the order that we record them. So I thought we would just kind of do another grab baggy episode, but with some specifics. I think we have some specifics in mind. So this weekend, the last episode we did, Chris, you asked me all about Empty Epsilon, and I invited you to a game that we played over the weekend with myself and a bunch of my friends.
Mm-hmm.
I'm interested in hearing your take on how it went.
Okay, so I think that the game played about how I expected it based off of what we had talked about, which is good, right? You know, it delivered that experience of, you know, having the different stations and so on. I was science officer, so I was mostly looking at a radar and scanning things, and like basically everybody's playing a different mini game, more or less. Like that's kind of the game, right? It's like a bunch of people collaborating on different mini games and communicating with each other, right?
Yeah, I mean, I guess in a traditional quote unquote mini game, you know, it's not really influential to the game itself, but you're right that each station is essentially doing a different thing, but it's all related, right? It's not like you're playing a Pac-Man mini game and I'm playing a Mario mini game, or, you know, it's that they're all related to the events that are occurring simultaneously.
Okay, mild tangent, but my statement is not too far off in that there's a board game that's called Space Cadets, very similar, that everybody's playing different roles, and there it feels more like mini games. Like one of them, you're playing effectively a like movement game where you're placing these different tiles and rotating them to try to figure out where the ship's going to move. One of them, you play a flick game, and so I feel like it's not too far off. But you're right. It's the difference between this and mini games is I think that a mini game feels like a solo activity. Like when I hear mini games, I imagine just people playing a bunch of things, and the stuff that they do isn't that important and doesn't affect stuff too much. And I feel like maybe that's kind of the thing that seems objectionable about this. Whereas here, what you're doing has to be in coordination with other people.
Yeah, I mean, so I was priming you for a specific answer, so I might as well just give you the answer I was expecting. So I know you had fun. Because you said, "Oh, this was fun," but the other half of that was, you know, I neglected to tell you in the last episode we talked about what a pain in the ass some of this stuff is, because you know free software people tend to write game engines, and it's usually a one or two person thing, and a lot of the polish that one normally has in these kind of systems isn't there. And so, for example,
okay, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, like, you know, server would crash, you know, every so often. Missions would be kind of hard to work through. Just a lot of the, I mean, a lot of the polish isn't there, which doesn't mean it's not fun. It just meant that, like, yeah, you know, the reality is that free software game is not all of them, but many of them have some rough edges.
Yeah, so you're right. The That did occur. We ended up having quite a few disconnects as we were playing the game. But I have partly an impression, and it's partly because you said so much to me, that part of the reason for that is that this game is expected to generally be played in the same room, effectively, like on a local area network, not over the internet. Is that effectively right?
I mean, it's weird because it's right and not right. It's right in that that was the original proprietary bridge simulator was absolutely built for this. But I know that the author of Empty Epsilon is at least tangentially involved with some online communities who play. And I would actually say that Empty Epsilon is better at internet play, but it's still not perfectly optimized for it.
Mm-hmm.
In that the server does, you know, kind of can crash when you change scenarios or when you change ships. It's just not perfect. But yeah. I don't want to harp on it not being perfect. Like, that's not the most important thing. I think the thing is, hey, you got to play. We got to play a game together. We, you know, for as much time as you and I spend talking, and we do talk a lot, and as much as both of us are into games, I think you and I have total played like 5, not even, games together. And in person, online, all, the whole thing.
Yeah, not that many. Yeah,
maybe even like 3 or 4, like very few.
Well, it was good. You know, like I think that despite the stops and starts, I'm glad I did it. And it gave me a nice feel for what that kind of thing was. And the other nice thing was that it was that opportunity to communicate with people, which it turns out Mumble ended up holding up pretty well again in this scenario. So
I thought we would use Discord. I had a really specific reason for recommending the proprietary software thing, which had to do with the idea that you could like make multiple rooms and channels, and I thought we would have lots of people, and we actually did have lots of people, but we couldn't get everyone. We couldn't get the coordination, blah 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 blah. But audio is actually harder to hear with Discord than it was with Mumble. Mumble worked better. And it was really amazing and kind of heartening to be like, oh, this Mumble thing works way better than this expensive, you know, well, this highly funded proprietary tool.
Well, I think that there's something to take out of that. Like so I feel like a lot of us have gotten kind of hyper-corrective for maybe the ways that free software used to be advertised in kind of the aughts, where like it was like everything's better, everything's blah blah blah, and we're like, oh, like get ready for all the ways in which free software is not doing as good, right? And but like, you know, it's I think it's that, you know, certain things end up being fantastic and certain things end up being not very fantastic. And I think that a lot of it, as you say, happens to be around the areas that are quote unquote polished versus not polished. But what the heck does polish mean? Like, which parts of a program are polish?
That's a good question. I mean, I think for games, there's some good answers. For other applications, I mean, we could go down this road. Let's go down this road a little bit, not too much. So I was watching someone review Nextcloud.
Mm-hmm.
And we had Frank from Nextcloud on, I think it was the episode before you returned.
Mm-hmm.
And I use Nextcloud. I like Nextcloud. But the argument that the person on YouTube had against Nextcloud was that the interface was inconsistent between applications.
Mm-hmm.
And he's right. Like, no joke, he's absolutely right. The interface is inconsistent. The iconography is inconsistent between applications. And some of this is because the icons and the interface are not all written by Nextcloud. But, you know, whatever the reason, it is true. So, you know, we could argue that consistency of expectation across the application is a component of polish. I would say stability of application is a component of polish. You know, and I don't know.
Audio appeal.
Yeah, visual appeal is definitely one. You know, does it feel good to use? And look, we're not UX people, but I think UX people would be able to say, oh, well, the reason you like this is because X, you know, reasons X, Y, Z.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I don't think we need to harp on that. There are some things I want to harp on, though.
Okay.
So I want to harp on an article that I posted last week based on a talk that you gave and the reception that my article about your talk got. And we'll link to all these things. But essentially, we talked about, you gave a talk at CopyleftConf, and you and I talked about it before you gave the talk and after you gave the talk. And I was expecting that this talk you gave about how the AGPL has these like big holes in it. And I'm going to exaggerate a little bit for effect, because that's how I, you know, like I try to give the big headline and then, you know, pull people in, right? Like, look at this big hole in the AGPL, or look at this big way that the AGPL isn't going to work. And I was expecting you to get a ton of attention, and it didn't. Like, you gave your talk, and maybe it's because the CopyleftConf talks weren't really published, I mean, other than a few.
Right, there's no recording of the talk, unfortunately, online.
Online, yeah. Apparently, they have it, but there's now been a subsequent CopyleftConf, so I don't think it'll ever be out. So I said, well, gee, you know, it's been a year. I pinged a few people in the free software community, some leadership about this, and didn't get very far. I'm not gonna name names or shame people, but I pinged a couple of prominent people in the community, and they were like, yeah, they were either like, yeah, I haven't had a chance to look at it or think about it, or they were like, yeah, there are other things. And I was like, well, wait, this is a major issue. So I posted this, I made this article, and it basically, look, it totally is just repeating what you said, but your talk used Lisp. And I was like, maybe the reason that no one picked up on this is that Chris used Lisp. I'll do the whole thing in Python, right? And if I do it in Python, it'll be so accessible that everyone will get it, and then they'll all be on our side.
Mm-hmm. So should we discuss what the talk actually said?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, go for it.
All right. So you're right that I used Lisp. I want to give some caveats. The talk was not the AGPL sucks type talk. I've been an advocate of the AGPL for a long time, but I've also had concerns kind of in the background that I've tried to poke and prod at people who are fairly knowledgeable on it for some time and didn't really get a lot of direction on it. So I eventually decided, you know what, I'm just going to give this talk at CopyleftConf. And you're right. I think that there wasn't as much of a response to it as I was expecting or hoping. It does concern me. And I think the AGPL is really great for, I think we should discuss what the AGPL is trying to solve first before we discuss what the challenges are.
Yeah, that's a good idea. So my read of the AGPL is that it came out of this kind of hole in the regular GPL, which is to say, in the regular GPL, if you, Chris, write a piece of software, and I take that software and I turn it into a network service where other people connect to my computer, I am, in a sense, distributing it because I am distributing the functionality of it,
mm-hmm.
but I am not obligated to give back to the community because I am merely running it on my own private computer. And so it was considered kind of a hole, right? A hole in free software where it's like, oh, well, if I run it as a service, I don't have to give back.
Right.
And so the,
yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, let's also contextualize the time at which it came out, was kind of the start of the Web 2.0-ish era, right? Where we saw client-server communication becoming huge, right? Like we saw a bunch of applications migrating away from the desktop to being in the browser, and we saw network services kind of really proliferate. And, you know, I think some of the original concerns for AGPL was like, well, what happens if, for example, GCC, you know, had a proprietary extension made to it? But I think that didn't end up happening as much of a concern as just like programs that were intended to be client to server applications, which users just had no control over the software that was running on the server, even though they depended on that day to day.
Yep. As you say, it came about at a time when, you know, it was this whole Web 2.0, and really that was just, web applications are able to start to look and feel like desktop applications.
Yep.
And that changed the model because suddenly you didn't have to run software on your own computer. You could just use a web application, and it didn't feel clunky or weird. It felt almost as good as just running a native application. So I want to also say, I think the AGPL is a great thing. In fact, I'm a big proponent of it and would like to see more software in the public sphere. And I think the AGPL is a great way to do that.
Yeah.
So starting there, we're both fans.
Yeah. So I am a fan and for specific things, right? So for the things that the AGPL was trying to solve in its era, right? So I think that, you know, I ran a software project called Media Goblin that was, you know, under the AGPL. And it was, you know, like a decentralized media publishing and viewing system. And I think that was a great fit, right? You know, for like a decentralized, you know, Flickr / YouTube type system, AGPL is a great fit. Likewise, I think Mastodon and Pleroma and PixelFed and PeerTube, all of those are kind of classic web client server applications, and the AGPL is a good fit.
So now let's now that Love Fest is over, let's clean up afterwards and start getting critical, which is actually not critical. So I hate when people do this, but I'm going to do it now. We're not saying this is like that the AGPL is totally, you know, burned to the ground. We're just like, oh, by the way, see this area.
There are concerns, right? So the name of the title of the talk was the boundaries of, I think it was the boundaries of network freedom, right? Copyleft and the boundaries of network freedom or something like that. And so that's really the framing that I wanted to provide. Like, what are the boundaries of our license-based approach to try to preserve user freedom, right? Like, what things should we try to do? And what are the potential unintended side effects? So this is where, let me introduce what I started to do in the talk, which is where I think you correctly pointed out that people got confused, and then we'll try to unconfuse the audience. So the reason my talk, I think, was not that well understood is I said, okay, and there will be a specific portion of the audience of our show who will like be like, this makes perfect sense. But I was like, okay, you know, part of the thing is we have this perception that there's a major difference between code and data in our software. You know, if I'm opening Audacity and recording this right now, there's Audacity, the program, and then there's the audio I'm recording in it, right? Two different things, right? And then I also have my configuration file for Audacity that's stored somewhere, and that's also data, right? Two separate things. And that's kind of the distinction that we're used to. So the part where things start to get messy is I'm like, well, okay, so look at Emacs on the other hand, and Emacs being a text editor that's written in Lisp, the Lisp community famously kind of says there's very little distinction between code and data. And when I configure Emacs, when I configure my mail client, for instance, and I have incoming mail, all of that configuration is actually written in code in Emacs Lisp. And that code, so when I say, okay, I'm filtering this email from this mailing list and this email to this mailing list. And also, oh, I'm going to run a function here. So since it's code and data, I can also embed a function that says, when this message comes in, run this test against it, and maybe we'll filter it into this folder if it passes a test, and we won't if it doesn't. But that function has to be, if you said that that function wasn't code, then you'd pretty much lose all the kind of defenses that we generally make around copyleft, right? Of the kind of source requirements, because it doesn't look very different.
I want to stop you, because I feel like we're going exactly down the road where I feel like you lost people last time.
Okay, great.
So for the people who, so look, we have a ton of very smart lispy people who listen to the show.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to be like, duh, right? Everything you said, like, that's obvious. But that's not most people. And that's what most people are not used to, programming their system like that.
Mm-hmm.
So let's just say it differently. There are systems in which there is no distinction between configuration and code, because the configuration itself is written in code and contains executable components. And that's all that encapsulates everything you just said, right?
Right. And so on the Fediverse, and I forget the name of the person who brought it up, but somebody pointed out that it may be easier to understand configuring web applications as an example of this, right? So your Django application or your PHP application may actually be written in either Python or PHP. Usually people are just putting in things like,
Some strings, stuff
like that, right? But if you start dumping in functions, then it gets more complicated. So
basically, if your configuration starts to do things like, test conditions, or starts to, run sorting internally, or any kind of thing where it's no longer just, variable equals string constant, then the lines start to blur about, well, wait, what is configuration and what is code?
Right. So the GPL generally doesn't have a big problem here, because the GPL effectively has the right to private modification, because the program that I'm running on my computer, it's really the thing that I'm distributing to somebody as a program, where I have to provide the source code and all the kind of rights that copyleft requires, right? But that's not the case once we introduce a network requirement for distribution, right? Because the reason is now, so let's take, just abstractly, let's imagine that I had some email client that for whatever reason, the filtering of my email into these different folders contained code. And you don't have to think about how it works, just that that's there. And now that means that if I'm communicating over the network with someone else, then in theory, that other entity on the network has the right to be able to see what my configuration is. And my code may be very specific in such a way that it reveals information about what kind of mailing list I'm subscribed to, and et cetera.
Well, let's talk about why that's the case, because I think that's another area where people might get lost. So as we just discussed, the Allegra GPL
specifies... I think it's the Afero GPL.
Afero, sorry. I always screw that up. Anyway, the Afero GPL
specifies live.
Yeah, semi-live. It's live as far as you know. So it specifies that if you make your network service available, that an end user of that network service has all the same rights as they would if you'd given them a binary copy, which means that they can ask for the source code.
Right.
Right. That's the whole raison d'etre of the Afero GPL.
Right.
So what Chris is saying is, okay, so if you're an end user of a system that's been configured like this, where it's not just, so it's obvious in some system, it's obvious that configuration is configuration and code is code. And it's understood that there's no distinction, or sorry, that there's a clear distinction, between configuration and execution. But the complicated part is that if you have a system where configuration is itself a dynamic, is dynamically generated through code or contains code, then the argument that the two are completely separate starts to break down. And you could make an argument that the two are in fact not separate. The more sophisticated the configuration is in terms of the way it's dynamically generated or dynamically executed. If it's just a set of, you know, variable one equals string one, variable two equals string two, we're not talking about that. That's not a big deal, and that's understood. But if it's something generating configuration, or the configuration again is doing something very interesting or bizarre, you know, then that argument starts to break down that the two are separate. And at that point, if someone is a user of the system and then they request the code, the argument that configuration should be exempt becomes harder to make.
Right. Let's also point out that this is more likely to come up in the kind of systems that I think we would like to move towards.
And by that you mean that you're building.
Yeah, the kind of systems that I'm trying to build, right? So more So first of all, we talked about, you know, the AGPL coming about and trying to solve the problems with client to server centric systems, right? So what happens when we move to more peer-to-peer systems, right? Now there's what we usually think of the AGPL trying to prevent against is the fact that there's this idea of there's this other entity, which could be like a corporation or somebody else who might want to lock things down for monetary reasons, and that they have to be able to keep things free. But what if it was everyone is effectively a client and a server in the system, and everyone has source distribution requirements? Once we introduce that, this is the first thing that starts to make this more complicated and something we have to think about more often. It's not just that servers have to think about it. Imagine if, and actually this could happen, imagine if your browser was written under the AGPL, like Firefox was, and you contact a server and the server wants to actually request the source code of your browser and say, hey, what are all the plugins you have installed, right? That would be pretty alarming, I think, right? And especially if it ended up involving what are the configuration of those plugins. Now imagine if your whole system is written in that kind of way.
I mean, and that's a very abstract, you know, thing, because most people are like, well, okay, but those are clearly client server. And what makes this interesting, I think, is that if we actually stop making analogies and just start talking about the kind of systems that you are building, in which there is no client and there is no server. There are just two peers communicating.
Right.
And that's it. And the other thing that makes it interesting is in the systems that you're building, the distinction between making GPL would call an at arm's length call and making a local call is invisible to the user, and even in some cases, invisible to the programmer. So you don't really know whether this object that you're running is running on your computer or on a computer halfway across the globe.
That's right. And so what we're used to thinking about, and the GPL does contain some text in it, I think it's non-normative, but that says that, the arm's length thing in there. And yeah, like what does arm's length mean when you have things talking over the network? Especially in the kind of systems that the way that we normally think of building programs in like a Web 2.0 type system is you have something like what's called a RESTful API that a programmer very carefully crafts and thinks about all of the design of that API that they're going to hand out to developers. In the kind of actor model based object capability systems that I'm working on, and I know I just threw out a ton of jargon, there, every single object in your system is potentially an API endpoint, every object. And then that means that you have to think about compliance for every object that you're interacting with. And if we had these two, if we objects A and B are in the same process, you'd be like, oh, absolutely, they're linked together. But what if one of them, the same code can operate off of whether they're in the same process or whether or not A and B are in completely different machines? What happens is in terms of linking requirements then?
Yeah. So that's, I mean, and that was pretty much the whole, you know, the whole argument was just, was essentially, you know, what we just said. And the feedback that I received from, I guess, a draft version or an early version, I should say, of my article was basically, you know, I don't see the problem, because I started talking about source code and source code generation, and I kind of overemphasized that point. But when I revised the article and started focusing more on the configuration part that we just talked about, the feedback I got was, well, it's obvious what's configuration and what's code, therefore this can't be a problem. And it's like, so your argument, I mean, and I actually said this on, I had this discussion on Reddit, and I was like, so your argument is that this can't be broken, right? It can't be this broken, therefore I must be wrong, right? And it's like, well, no, I and Chris are not wrong. It's the license that there's an impedance mismatch between what we want it to say and what it actually says.
Yeah. So I think that there's, yeah. So there were a number of comments have been like, well, that effectively that can't be what the implementers meant. And I think what you and I are saying is that's right.
That's right.
Yeah. Like, that's right. No,
they didn't mean this.
Yeah. That wasn't right. Intended. Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, but the same thing happens in software as it does in legal documents, right? I can say, well, I mean, granted, with legal documents, there's sometimes a human being that's interpreting them and trying to think about intent, but that can only go so far. But even in with software, you know, I may not have intended to release a bug in the software. That doesn't mean that there's not a bug.
Yeah. So that's it. I mean, we'll post the link. And hopefully, so actually, I want to talk, there's one last part. Chris, you, in your talk, had a conclusion that I disagree with.
Okay.
So your conclusion was the GPL is a suitable license, and my read was basically, just use the GPL. So, it'll solve this problem.
So can I defend why what that was, and then you can disagree with why? So let me give the explanation for the talk.
The whole talk? No, just
that end part.
Okay.
Okay, so yeah. what I was saying was the GPL still does something really effectively, right? So if you imagine that you had some game and you had this really cool monster, like a fire elemental or something like that, and that gets distributed to you over the network, maybe even in binary form, if you're getting the binary code distributed to your computer for that fire elemental, the GPL should apply and you should be able to get the source code for it. However, if you're interacting with something that's on the other end of the network, you're just talking to a reference to that fire elemental, then basically you have rights to the things that you actually get handed to you. But for the things that aren't handed to you, you don't necessarily get rights to those, which is how the GPL was intended to work in the first place. And I think in these kinds of systems I'm talking about, more peer-to-peer systems where the distinction between code and data is much smaller, I think that that's actually great. Like, that's actually perfectly acceptable.
And I would say yes, but. And my yes, but is yes, but you've already said this in this conversation, but I'm going to repeat it because I think it's important. You're talking about a peer-to-peer world
Uh-huh.
And that world that you're building is not the world we're in right now. And my perspective is that the Affero GPL or another license could be written to potentially address the issues that we've pointed out without just saying, well, we'll default back to the GPL. I agree with you that in the case of that in the case of a peer-to-peer world of the type you're talking about, that you may be that I will concede that you may be right, that the GPL may actually be a great license, and we have a whole we should have a whole separate conversation about, you know, what the implications of that are, and I'm sure we will. But I think we can address some of these issues now with modifications to the Affero GPL.
I'm not necessarily convinced that's true. It may be possible, but I would have to see what they are before I could comment on them. Right.
Yeah. Anyway, so that was. I don't think we're going to get anywhere, right, with talking about this.
Well, do we want right to talk now. About? Let me throw this out here, or we could say, "Whoa, this is too big of a topic. Let's save that for a different time." But there, one of the things that people really responded to strongly was about stuff like neural networks and genetic programs, which is
I was going to go there. So the question is, what happens when you either have no source code because some process has generated the source code, or a more kind of down-to-earth version that people can understand today is, what if your program execution is based on a set of machine learning training data? So, you know, let's talk about something like Mozilla Speech, Deep Speech. So you can download Mozilla Deep Speech, that training, you know, the training data, not the training data, but the executable data. And that executable set, I think, is like, I want to say it's like a couple of gig. But the training data, the actual data that it's based on, is like terabytes.
Right.
And the question is, so if that... In this peer-to-peer world that you're talking about, if I said, well, give me the source code for your speech system, you might be like, well, the source code to my speech system is all of my training data plus all of the random number generator seeds, you know, plus, plus, plus.
Right.
And I'd be like, well, that's what you have to give me, right? If I want to be able to replicate your work. And that would pose a huge burden.
Let's put it that.
And
yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let's. I like fun gamey examples, as you know. And I'm going to tie it back to something more serious in a second. What if we imagine we had this distributed game, and we had something like, we'll call it Libremon, like a free software Pokemon, except that the monsters were literally genetically engineered. Like, they use genetic programming, like, you know, one, like, the programming language PushGP or something like that, where the monsters, you had them fight each other, and then whoever won, literally it breeds a new offspring program between the two of them. And no human writes it, right? It's just generating that thing. And so you get this new bred thing. The source code, in theory, is every single fight that ever happened through all time. Right, and all the monsters that bred together, right? Do you need to have access to all of that time? And my feeling is no. You know, similarly, if I actually encounter a real frog and I, you know, sequenced that frog and got all the DNA code for that frog, I feel like what I really need there is the right to be able to have the right to study. Well, okay, now we're getting into real genetic engineering. So let's back to the game version. Modify, distribute the game frog instead, we'll say.
Yeah, so I'm going to say that to answer this question gets to the heart of free software, which is, why do we want the right to study? It's not just for some esoteric reason. It's because we believe that having the source code increases the sum of human knowledge. I would have an argument that the system upon which the Libra, what did you call it? Libra monster?
Libremon.
Libremon was built is the knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the actual monster. Now, of course, you may be able to take the monster apart and understand its genetic code, but it's not every single fight. It's how the system is put together.
Here's a question that sometimes gets well, I like to throw around at least. If we could go back in time. So let's make a distinction between the GPL and CC BY-SA, right? CC BY-SA has no source code requirement. However, I think it's valuable that the GPL has a source code requirement for software. For things like this podcast, I don't think it would be great, because I think that it would be very expensive for us to host all of the source code for these shows, right?
I don't even know what the source code for this show would look like, because when I use Audacity to edit the show, I don't do it in a way that's like, I can't programmatically recreate. I'd love actually to be able to do that, but I can't programmatically recreate the show. You know, all the little things, like when I edit out someone's, you know, chair squeaking, whether it's yours or mine, or whether I, you know, edit out a click or whatever.
Or if I'm breathing too heavy into the mic.
Or I do this and I do the same thing, right? Each of those edits, you know, we would have to be able to programmatically, you know, recreate, and the software I'm using doesn't allow for that. I mean, it just doesn't have that as an option.
Well, the GPL V3 does very usefully say the preferred form for modification, right? So you could say that maybe at some point this is the preferred form you have is just the Audacity files, you know, maybe a multi-track Audacity file that you happen to have at that time. Like, that's the best form that you had. But even that, I feel like, is like a little bit too much to ask, is to say, keep those FLAC files around and keep those Audacity files around, right? So I think that there's, for source code and for computer programs, we really lucked out in that our the way that we write programs happens to not be that expensive to store and kind of keep the history around of, and that's not the case for some other creative endeavors.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I've heard experts in this area talk about, like, well, gee, wouldn't it be amazing if we could do, you know, if we could study the creation of work, you know, in this way and have all the various steps. And I'm like, yeah, maybe it would be, right? Maybe it would be awesome.
Yeah, I mean, I've gotten a lot out of watching the Blender Open movie, like, The Blender Institute puts out these open movies, and I've actually opened up, they release all the Blender files for them, and I've actually opened them up and studied them. They're not required to do that, but I've gained a lot of value from the fact that that's there.
Yes. But it would be hard if it was required all the time.
Right. So here's a question. This is a question that is, let's acknowledge on the face, is a little bit farcical, because it's not going to happen. If you could go back in time before software was able to be copyrighted, and you said you have one of two paths available to you in the future, where one of which is software never becomes copyrightable, and the other one is software becomes copyrightable and all these terrible things happen, but we're able to use the copyright to be able to require that people give away source code for software. Which direction would you choose at that point in time? And for me, it feels obvious, like, oh, obviously I would choose no copyright, right? And despite the fact that I'd still want source code to be available. So that strikes me as if, like, there's a desire for a normative requirement, even in the absence of source requirements, to have software, to have source code, to say, we would like you to keep around the source code in many of these cases, but we don't live in that universe. We can't rewind time, and we're almost completely unlikely to be able to do that. So I think source requirements for software continue to be really useful, because we're not going to get to that point anytime soon.
See, it's funny, because I come to this weird conundrum and end up actually flip going on the opposite side of you for the same exact reason, but I come to the opposite conclusion, which is, so I believe it was Iceland's, and I might be wrong about the country because I don't have my research in front of me about this because we didn't plan this, but there was a pirate party in one of the, I believe, northern countries and Scandinavian countries, and they put out a statement saying, we want no software to be copyrightable. And the FSF said, or I believe it was the FSF, said, well, wait a second. If you do that, then there's no more protections for copylefted software. And I think in a world in which we never had software copyright, then what we would have ended up with is trade secrets.
I feel like you could argue against, so what we could argue is a couple of things. One of them is, what if you had the right to be able to study any binary program you got? Like, you have the right to study everything you got, and we never outlawed outlawed reverse engineering. And then on top of that, we encouraged a strong norm. So, you know, for example,
well, that's different. Hold on. Now you're adding new things to your scenario, and then retroactively going, see, if you just add all these things, you said if we just had never had copyright. And my argument is that if we, in a world in which we never had copyright for software, we would have ended up here anyway, because the powers that be would have used other mechanisms to compel uncooperative behavior.
So let's say there are a suite of intellectual restriction tools, sometimes called intellectual property, but I like intellectual restriction. So for example, patents and software and copyright and trademarks, to all some degree, are intellectual restriction tools, and they all operate very differently.
I don't agree about trademark, but okay.
Let's keep going. Still an intellectual restriction tool, but it's more justifiable in some cases, maybe. But it still does the thing where your application has to be, you know, the way that you convey ideas has to be controlled.
I would call them censorship tools, but sure, let's keep going.
So we could go further and say, let's say we had a point in time. So you're right. I'm modifying the scenario. Let's say we had, we could go back in time and say, you know what, we're going to ban all of those intellectual restriction laws when it comes to software. We're just not going to permit any of those to apply. And we're going to encourage strong norms around sharing software. And
Well, in that case, then it becomes obvious, right? Then it just, now you've just waited so much that there's only one possible outcome.
Well, right, and again, this is a reality we're never probably going to see in our lifetimes, right?
But at that point, it's like, you know, it's not Sophie's choice. Now she only has one daughter, right? It's like, well, what's Sophie's choice?
Well, maybe I think that part of the point there is that the reason why there is a grasp towards copyright as that tool is because of a fear that other groups have other tools to lock things down that we don't have access to, and this is effectively the tool that we've had. But I want to lean on that for a little bit, which is to say that I think that for those who really think a lot about free software and user freedom, a lot of the effort and emphasis we put on how to solve problems is thinking about what are the ways to solve them in licenses, because people who really are interested in free software tend to be the ones who pay attention to licenses. And that ends up with a temptation to say, let's try to solve all the problems in licenses. And there may be other layers on which to solve problems. And I think this is a tangent, but I think this is entirely related to the, you know, the use restriction licenses that we're seeing become very popular for reasons, things that I'm very sympathetic to. Turns out there was one that was posted, which is called the vaccine public license, that said anyone can use this except for anti-vaxxers, basically. Which is like, I really care about that. I think vaccines are like, vaccinating the public is very important, but I don't think that you want to put that clause in a license.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, we talked about this a little bit while you were gone with the episode of Molly DeBlanc, about why putting these things. So what you're speaking to is that while we talked about why it's not a good idea to put these kind of restrictions in the license, you're saying, well, these kind of things could be put elsewhere. Where I Well, so let's talk about that a little bit. A question copyright, and I've mentioned this, I don't know, ad nauseum. We talked about how you could use trademark as a tool to encourage it. And the other component of this is that we believed that that the fans of the work would be the ones pushing for fairness, et cetera. That essentially the community would cohese. Is that a word? Cohese?
Sure.
Around authors that they supported. What the distinction I want to make though is that there's a distinction between using the tools of the systems that we are pushing against, which is why it's copyleft, right? Because we're using copyright against itself, or trademarks, which again we're using a legal mechanism. And I think what you're saying, which is, well, there are non-legal mechanisms we could also use.
That's right. So let me back up, because it may sound like I'm suddenly a very anti-copyleft person, and I'm not, right? Like, I actually think that the GPL is great, and that was the conclusion to my talk, you know, was that the GPL is an excellent tool because it turns kind of the teeth of the machine against itself. And I think that that's wonderful. And I think that that's absolutely wonderful. And I think there are other problems that we may want to solve, which are, you know, so I think what should be in a free license is effectively the things that undo the kind of damage caused by intellectual restriction laws. Like, that's the stuff that fits in a free software license and not much else. But I think that there are other problems we want to solve, and we can take a multi-layered approach to solve them. So, for instance, code of conducts are a great way to solve. I think that they're really important for being able to set community expectations of behavior, but they're not. Code of conducts are not currently actually checked into copyright licenses. They're separate files checked into in a repository. And that's on a separate layer, and I think that works great. And similarly, you and I are both very concerned about the ability to distribute private, distribute and share data in a peer-to-peer network and maintain privacy. But instead of encoding that in a software license, we're trying to develop the technology to actually use encryption to provide those guarantees. And that's a separate layer than using the legal tool.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I would in some ways say that that's more kind of classic free software in the sense of, like, you know, we programmers only, fall back on legal tools when we have to. Right, like we don't really like using the legal tools, but we don't have another great way of compelling people to behave, be excellent to. We don't have a way of compelling people to be excellent to each other, that's strong other than the legal mechanisms.
Yes, yeah, I think that's true.
Or within the domains in which we control, hence code of conduct, because codes of conduct only work in so much as the community that they're in enforces
right.
them.
It's a community normative tool. And I think that that's wonderful. So I think it's really nice that we have this light episode about space games.
Yeah.
I wonder if anybody started listening to this episode and they're like, oh, they're talking about FD Epsilon again. I just want to tune in for the software stuff. And then, you know, or we're like, I just want to tune in for the space game thing, and then ended up in the reverse. But, you know, you all asked for it. You asked for an off the cuff, more casual conversation about Fuser Freedom, and what you got, what you
and
got.
And this is what we do. Yeah. You want to know how we really talk? It's not like on the other hand, I have no idea what normal people talk about. Like, I have no idea what a normal two-person conversation sounds like. This is an entirely normal conversation for us and for other people we
why,
know.
Why would it, what people don't talk about this every day?
yeah, those are sane people. Don't talk about this every day. Oh man, we've had almost an hour of this. Holy moly! So, I don't know. Is there anything? I know we actually had other things. We're like, oh yeah, we could talk about this. We could talk about that.
I wanted to talk about accounting again, should... but you know.
Yeah, we could talk. I mean, we could talk about accounting. But you know what? We're doing so many episodes that I want to give your accounting thing so much time that people can skip. I mean, listen to in detail. I actually have thoughts on accounting myself, but other than just plain text.
We should
accounting,
not but... switch to as heavy slash dry as a slash thrilling of a topic as accounting. After something so heavy, I think
after
I think...
such a thrilling license episode,
I think we need to wind this down. Anyway, I hope that people can listen to this and understand that we're coming to this stuff from a position of. A position of love. Yeah, not from a
No, genuinely, like this is a discussion of people who love this stuff and love this software and love the licenses. This is not like we're not tearing it down. We're not punching, you know, we're not punching down. We're saying like, hey, we need to strengthen free software.
Yeah.
All right. So, how can people get involved with this thrilling topic? I want to say something snarky here, but I'll end it with, they can join us on Hash Libre Lounge on Freenode. I was the snarky thing is, well, they can go to the FSF channels or the Conservancy channels and have these same conversations.
Everybody's so overwhelmed in the free software community. We want to be nice to each other.
Okay. Well, this is an episode made of love, right?
That's true.
Spread the love.
We should all open the window at 7 p.m. and all start yelling outside all of our opinions about licenses.
Well, that's not the kind of expression. So what Chris is referencing is that in many places, people are opening their windows and yelling at 7 p.m. in support of healthcare workers during this COVID epidemic, just making noise so that people that work in the healthcare industry, you know, doctors, nurses, and others, know that they have our support and our love, and you know, make that known. So don't air your grievances out the window. Show your support for people who are risking their lives to help others in this time. And when you're not doing that, come on Hash Libre Lounge on Freenode and join us, or email us at podcast@librelounge.org. Find us at the Fediverse at librelounge@floss.social, or find us on Twitter at Libre Lounge, and help, you know, give us feedback. Tell us what you thought of the show. Tell us why we're wrong. More importantly, tell us why we're right. And
we're getting a bit punchy towards the end of this hour, I think.
Well, it's also past my bedtime, and you're going to be like, wait, it's only 9 p.m. as we're recording this. And that's right. It's past my bedtime. And, so thanks for listening to us. And, we hope that you'll join us again soon.
Take care.
All right. Bye.
You've been listening to Libre Lounge. You can find and subscribe to us at LibreLounge.org. This podcast is released under the Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 4.0 International License. Our theme music is Bossa Nova by Joth, which is waived into the public domain under CC0 and which you can find on OpenGameArt.org. If you'd like to support Chris Weber's work on this and other user freedom projects, you can donate at patreon.com/CWEBBER. Thanks for listening. See you next time.